we go. Okay, so thank you for inviting me. This is the second time this year already I've had a, I've been at a statistics graduate day, graduate whatever, I get the right presentation. The other one was at UBC, so I guess I now have a rule, which is that Canadian universities do things right, have grad students organize days, and maybe that's the reason there's so many prominent statisticians who are Canadians. So let me, one small complaint is that if you guys weren't 3 hours east of me, it would be a lot easier. Losing that 3 hours of sleep in the morning is not easy. But I guess if you were to do that, you'd be in the middle of Alberta somewhere, and that wouldn't be, I wouldn't come visit you. So let's see. All right, so I've got a talk in two parts here, so I'm struggling just a minute here to get it going. Okay, there we go. So it's talking several parts, really, that are kind of loosely related to the title. Sounds really grandiose and all. That's really, with apologies, I don't have so many grandiose things to say. But the title sort of unites some of the themes I want to bring out. Okay, so this has to do with scalability issues fundamentally. And this comes from a dissatisfaction of an experience that I often have in the applied world. So I live in the Bay Area, so I go down and give talks at places like Google and Yahoo and so on from time to time. And I tell them about some brand new methodology I'm all excited about. And they say, well, great, I have a petabyte of data. Will your methodology run on my data? And I say, well, and I say something like, probably not, but if you were to throw away most of your data and reduce it to a small subset, it would run on that. And I say, that's not exactly what we have in mind. I say, moreover, if you do that, all the guarantees, the theory I could provide is, are gone now because I don't really know how to subsample statistically. So, okay, they're not satisfied. Sort of what kind of field are you really in here? Is this a serious field? You know, you can't give us any guarantees. Moreover, they say things like, I need a decent answer quickly within an hour, a minute, or millisecond. And moreover, not no matter how much data I give you. Okay, so if I give you a little bit of data, I expect you to give me a quick answer. But if I give you a lot of data, somehow, you know, we're in this world where we expect that to take longer because we run algorithms, but that shouldn't somehow be right. Data is a resource. I should be only happier if I get more and more data. But here, I've run on some algorithm and it stops running in the available time and I don't know what to do. I have to throw up my hands. So again, I have to throw out lots of the data. And if all inferences were at square root of n somehow, I would know how the rate at which to throw away data to preserve my risk. But all inferences aren't square root of n inferences, and so I don't know how much data to throw away to preserve my risk. And I think that's the state we're in. And that's a very unsatisfying state. I can't provide any such guarantees. So these guys say, well, we're not going to pay attention to you guys. You statisticians just don't, you're not an engineering field yet. You can't really solve the problems we want to solve. And I think that's actually true. So I think in 50 years, maybe we'll not be in this situation, but we currently are in this situation. You give me a terabyte of data, you know, go talk to someone else, not a statistician. Okay, that doesn't seem right. All right, well, on the other hand, you know, you open up a stat book and it tells you about the asymptotic regime, large N or large P, but certainly very large N should be no problem. There should be no error bars in anything. There should be no inference issues at all, really. Maybe some computational issues, but those aren't that important. So what's the big deal here? So, you know, to a statistical audience, I don't have to sort of say that's wrong, but let me just belabor it just a few minutes anyway. To a non-statistical audience, you really have to belabor this. They just don't get this point. And it's really just the kind of multiple hypothesis testing issues, but let's just belabor it for a minute. Think of your data as a design matrix of some kind. I've got rows and columns. So I've got instances or entities or units or whatever you want along the rows, and I've got features or covariates or attributes or whatever you want to call them around the columns. And it's just a kind of a fact about our lives that if you have not very many rows, you don't tend to need very many columns. But as the number of rows grow, you measure more and more columns. So if I have 1,000 people in my database, I'll collect a little bit of data about each people, you know, their age, their height, their weight, their income or something. And maybe that's enough to start to say interesting things that I want to say. But if I collect 3 billion rows, so I get a large fraction of all humanity, which is what's happening nowadays on the web in all kinds of domains, I'm going to be interested in lots of other things about them. I'm going to be interested in what books they like to read, what restaurant they ate at yesterday, what city they live in, you know, markers in their genome, and so on and so forth. So I can make predictions at the scale of the individual. You know, are you likely to buy some other book? Are you likely to buy life insurance? Are you likely to get a disease of some kind? And so on and so forth. And that's the regime we're in the real world. That's what many companies are trying to do, and that's what the world, where the world is heading. But the problem, of course, is that the hypothesis space I'm interested in is usually something that grows exponentially in the number of columns. So I'm interested in the probability that if you live in Berkeley and you like statistics and you like punk rock music, that you'll go to Italy every summer. Okay? Now, in the database, actually, that has a probability of 1, because that person who lives in Berkeley, likes statistics, and likes punk rock, that's me, and I go to Italy every summer. All right? Now, that happens to be probably true of other people who come to Berkeley and have those features. They'll probably go to Italy, too, but, you know, not necessarily. So in any database, as you well know, most such kind of little hypotheses are true with probability 1 in the database, but they don't generalize to the future. And most of them are just due to noise alone. And so, if we have a growing linearly number of rows and a linearly growing number of columns, and our hypothesis space is exponential the number of columns, and that is reality, then we have a growing mess. We have a growing number of false positives, a growing burden, and this is what society is facing. And I think, you know, only, you know, a small handful of people in the statistics world know that this is what we're facing. You read about big data, and everybody talks about the greatness, the great things that are going to happen because of big data, and that's certainly true. But there is the kind of, you know, classical pessimistic statistics perspective, which is that bad things are going to happen. Let's be careful. All right, so the other side of the coin is the computational one, and it is important too. And it really has to do also with the time issue. So I really want a decision in an hour. If you give me a decision in 2 hours, it doesn't do me any bit of good, say, okay? Not untypical situation. So you run some algorithm, and it runs in cubic time in the number of data points, or cubic times in the covariate space. Right, so I give you a little bit of data, and you run, and you're fine. Your solution comes in before an hour, and the decision's made, everybody's happy. I give you more data, and eventually, your algorithm is too slow for the hour. So what do you do at that point? Well, maybe you back off to a cheaper algorithm, you know, some approximate scheme of some kind. You got to be careful, you know, approximate algorithms aren't necessarily faster, but maybe you found one that's faster. But it's cheaper in some way, and probably the risk has gone up a bit. All right, now you can probably, because it's faster, get more data in there, in your allotted time, and so maybe the risk didn't go up. But those are a lot of maybes. Okay? It's quite possible, as you backed off to a cheaper algorithm, that the risk actually increased as you got more data. All right? And that seems paradoxical and wrong, and I think it is wrong, but it's reality. All right? The other thing you do, again, is start to throw away data, subsample data. But again, you don't know typically how much statistical value each data point has, and if you subsample at the wrong rate, again, your risk can increase as you get more and more data. All right, so that, I think, again, that's just dead wrong, and that can't be the case. We have this resource coming in, more of it's coming in, and we're doing worse and worse. But that's, I think, where we currently are. So here's one way to express a goal that we should work on as theoreticians. Given an inferential goal and a fixed computational budget. So let's be clear about that. If we don't have that, it's not as interesting. Provide a guarantee that the quality of inference will increase monotonically as data accrue without bound. So I'm more of a statistician, but I think this statement is a nice kind of computer scientist version of the problem, which is without bound. Really, this is a scalability issue we should face once and for all. Let's find the principles that allow us to scale. So we have to think about this problem again and again as data get larger and larger over time. Okay? And are there such principles? So I've worked a bit on this problem, kind of theoretically, and made minimal progress on it. It's very hard to do this, even in like a, say, linear regression. I do hope to kind of eventually have a solution, but I think it'll take a while. The field will eventually arrive at such a solution, but it's going to be hard. So in the meantime, I'm coming at the problems at a slightly different way, kind of more bottom-up, and so I'm going to look at some computational principles that are, you know, serious computational principles that really have big impact on computer science, and try to bring them into statistics more fully. So the one that I'm going to focus on today is divide and conquer. So many algorithms in computer science are divide and conquer algorithms. It's really, you know, amazing how many simple algorithms could be viewed as divide and conquer. You know, great principle. Take a really hard problem, find ways to break it up, and then solve the individual pieces and bring it back together. And one reason I like to focus on this is not just the power, but also it's somehow a little bit in conflict with statistics. Statistics is somehow about aggregating things. If you aggregate in the right way, pull things together, you know, you can do great things. You can make inferences. All right, so this is kind of a little bit of a conflict here, but I think it's the fact. You have to do divide and conquer, and you have to aggregate. So you kind of, our field is somehow about bringing these two principles together that somehow conflict a bit. Okay, so let's start with the first one, divide and conquer version of the bootstrap. So I assume in this audience, everyone, how many know what the bootstrap is? All right, so almost all of you. I've asked that question in other audiences. I've given this talk now probably half a dozen times. It's new work, but It's amazing how few people know what the bootstrap is outside of a stat audience. So we've done a bad job of educating the outside world on some of our most powerful tools. It's amazing. You could take, in fact, a whole curriculum in undergrad stat, and you don't ever see the bootstrap, which I think is just ridiculous. Okay, so anyway, now to my colleagues. These are students and postdocs working with me at Berkeley. We've been working a couple of years on this issue. Okay, so I'll tell you about kind of why we got back at looking at the bootstrap again after 40 years of here pretty soon. It has to do with the scale issues, but let's just remind you a little bit what the bootstrap is. I've got data. I've got some kind of an estimator. I'm going to be thinking about plug-in estimators. So it's a functional of the data. And of course, it doesn't have to be literally a parameter. It can be a prediction or a function of some kind I'm estimating. And I don't care about the parameter estimate per se. I care about some assessment of the quality of the estimate. For example, I'm going to focus mainly on confidence regions. Okay. So again, a stat audience, of course, everyone focuses on it. If I give this talk to a machine learning audience, they'd say, what are confidence intervals? Okay, so what do we want out of an estimator? Or, how do we quantify estimator quality? Well, in statistics, we've mainly focused on accuracy. I want to have a frequentist guarantee. I give you a confidence interval. I claim that it's a 95% confidence interval. 95% of the time, as you get data sets, it should cover the truth. That's what it means to be accurate, and then do that, maybe at some rate, 1 over n, ideally, which is what actually happens. Secondly, we want it to be automatic. We don't have to rethink every time we get a brand new problem. It should sort of just apply without much analysis or special case effort. So things like the bootstrap do meet these two criteria. What it doesn't meet, however, is the third criteria we're going to bring into play now to be scalable. And I'll talk about that here pretty soon. So this is now, again, reminding you what the bootstrap is, just to kind of set up my new version of the bootstrap here a little bit later on. So bootstrap is really just an expression of the frequentist way of thinking. It's the ultimate frequentist kind of algorithm, if you will. So what the ultimate frequentist wants to do is to not just have one data set, but have many data sets. And then you calculate your estimate, you run your statistical procedure on each data set, and now you have a spread of values of that estimator. That's called a sampling distribution. And once you have a spread of those values, you can plug them into some formula to calculate an error, a confidence interval, error bar, bias, all sorts of things. So that's what you do if you have multiple data sets. Of course, you only have one data set, so you got to somehow, it seems unachievable. You can't do this. All right, but the clever idea, there's a clever idea that says you should more or less can. The way to think about it is to think about there's an underlying population from which data are coming, and the picture of the bootstrap is over here. I've got data, the population sitting here, and I'm the supreme being. I have that population, so I can generate not just one data set, but multiple data sets, and I can generate M of them. I can get my estimator values on each one of them, and I can plug them into a formula for a confidence interval. Okay, now that's what you could do if you were the supreme being. I'm not the supreme being, I don't have the population, but I do have a sample from the population. And now the key kind of conceptual step is to think of that sample as a histogram, think of the empirical distribution. So I plotted it there, and then forget that it came from n data points. It's a distribution itself, right? And in a lot of well-known ways, it approximates the population uniformly. Okay? So now forget that there ever was a population and just pretend that that histogram there, is that empirical distribution, is the population. So now you're a supreme being in a world in which that's the truth. That's the underlying population. Okay? All right. And now you do what the supreme being did in the other world. You generate not just one data set, but multiple data sets from that. So that's the interesting step. How do you generate a data set from that histogram? Well, it's just a distribution. You sample from it. And what that means is that you take the original data, you sample them with replacement. If you just think about it for a minute. Okay? So we have the same picture as before, but we've now put in the data here. We resample the data with replacement. That just means a sample from the empirical distribution. And now you get M copies, M, not copies, M resamplings, bootstrap samples of the original data. And then you do the same thing as before. One interesting point to make about this, and this is why I started thinking about it again, was that this is totally parallelizable. I just take the original data, and then I send one bootstrap, for example, to one server, another to another server, and I've got M servers. And they do their work entirely in parallel, and I pull them back together. So if you know about the computational world these days, you've heard about MapReduce. This is kind of classic MapReduce paradigm. Send things out to servers and bring them back in. Moreover, how big should M be? And the rule of thumb is for point estimates, a couple of hundred is enough just to beat down Monte Carlo error. And so a couple of hundred servers, that's easy to get nowadays. So So you can easily imagine cloud computing being used to do bootstrap error bars for things and start to control errors over big data sets. Okay, so that sounds great, but there's a gotcha, there's a hitch. And basically the hitch is the following, that if I do a bootstrap resample, I get 0.632 of the original data points appear in the bootstrap resample. So if I have a terabyte of data, that means that each resampling is 632 gigabytes. And I can't send 632 gigabytes to M servers on a network. That's too big. That's hopeless. And even in maybe 40 years, that may be not so hopeless. A petabyte will not work. You know, this is not going to work in general to sample that much data. All right, so we kind of are a little bit of a problem here. We are talking about big data and everything. Bootstrap's one of our wonderful principles that gives us error bars on all kinds of interesting statistical procedures. Can't do it on a terabyte of data. Okay, so what do? All right, we can't just say we can't do that. All right, and moreover, if we start to subsample the data and look at smaller data sets, we've lost something important. We're trying to get confidence intervals here. And the confidence intervals are based on the size of the data. If you look at smaller data sets, that's on the wrong scale. Okay. And again, let me puzzle about that for a second. It's kind of a problem. Our great principles can't be used in the modern world of big data. Now, of course, you have to think about this a little bit. That can't be right. There's got to be ways to use it, but it's not easy to immediately obvious how to do it. All right, so one obvious sort of idea you might have is some sort of subsampling procedure. And there is a literature on this. There's something also known as the M out of N bootstrap, which is a similar idea. And we thought this might kind of solve the problem, but it doesn't really, as I'm going to show you here in a minute. So subsampling, what is subsampling? It starts with the population conceptually, then it gets a sample size N, and then it takes a further subsampling of that, IID. Okay, so now B, think of that as something like square root of N, so a big reduction in the number of points. And now the procedure is that I plug in, I use my estimator on this, and now there's not just one way to get B points out of N, there's many ways to do it. Just N choose B ways to do it, and so I get some fraction of those, and on each of them I apply my estimator, and I get a spread now, and then I plug that into my confidence interval formula. But as I mentioned, that's wrong. They're on the wrong scale. The error bars are going to be too big because they're based on smaller amounts of data. So I've got to rescale the error bars, the confidence intervals. And what do I rescale by? Well, if it's a square root of N estimator, I can maybe rescale by square root of N over B. But I'd have to know that a priori. I'd have to done the math to figure out that, you know, do the asymptotics, and even the asymptotics might be quite right. So this is not nearly as automatic as a classical bootstrap, and it's not as desirable for that reason. Okay, but there's a worse problem too, which is that you've got to decide how to do this subsampling. In other words, you've got to decide what fraction of N data points to choose. Okay, so that just summarizes subsampling. I'll just not persist on that. So we did a little experiment, a bunch of experiments to sort of evaluate this as a real world large scale procedure. So here's just an example, multivariate linear regression. We've got a covariate space, D equals 100, I should have called that P maybe, and 50,000 data points. Covariates come out of a student T, and we're doing least squares. And now we're going to estimate confidence intervals. We know the truth because we generated this synthetically, and I'm going to do this for various values of B as a power of N. So N to the 1/2 might be what I'd hope to get. That would be really a lot of data reduction. But I'm going to go from 1/2 up to 1. And here are the results of this little Monte Carlo experiment. So this is time. This is I'm running on one computer, doing the subsampling procedure or doing the bootstrap and sort of seeing how my accuracy is improving. It won't go to zero because the number of data points has been fixed here, but it's going to go down, hopefully. Here's the bootstrap. And then here are various curves for subsampling with a gamma equal to 0.5, 0.6, 0.7, 0.8, and so on. So at 0.5, it's failing. It's not working. Really bad. 0.6, it starts to do better. That's the green curve. Then for 0.7, 0.8, it actually beats the bootstrap. And then for 0.9, it does worse again. Okay, and you wouldn't know this a priori. You're just running the thing, and there's some curve, and it's flattened out, and everything looks fine, but it's wrong. You're getting a bad wrong answer. All right, and the problem is that value gamma that worked there, that's problem dependent. On other problems, it's another place, so you don't know that a priori. Okay, so that's a real problem. You can't roll this out on a piece of software for people to use. And it's not easy to think about ways to set that automatically. There's been a little literature on doing that, and it's pretty assumption-ridden and not so practical. So I view that as just not a good solution at this point. Okay, so let's think about a new procedure. So I'm going to propose one today called Bag of Little Bootstraps. It's a kind of two-level procedure. And the name really suggests exactly what it is. Okay, so it's kind of a hybrid of bootstrap and subsampling. So let's think about subsampling a little more clearly. Why does subsampling make sense? And bootstrap kind of obviously makes sense. What about subsampling? Well, here's the picture. You got N points and then you went down to B. Well, you can ignore the fact that you went through this intermediate stage of N. Those B points also came IID from the population. So they're a representative sample of the population also. So just forget about the endpoints that were in the intermediate stage, okay? All right, and now, just like before, that histogram, that empirical, is an approximation of the population. Now, in my picture, it looks bad because I have so few points, but if I have a terabyte of data and B is, a few megabytes, it'll probably not be a bad approximation also, okay? Now, again, forget that this came from B points. It's just an empirical distribution. I can sample from it as many times as I want. I can sample from it B times, and that would be okay, but that's on the wrong scale. Here's the idea. The whole idea is in this next sentence. Sample from that empirical N times, not B times. All right? That's what the bootstrap tells you to do. You've got an empirical distribution. You want to get error bars for estimators based on N points. Sample from whatever distribution you have N times. All right? All right, so what does it mean to sample from that thing N times? Well, there's only B actual points there. That means many of them will recur many times. All right, so just keep a count of the number of times each point gets resampled. And most of those counts won't be zero at this point. Most of them will be big integers. So that's the idea. You pretend the subsample is the population. You sample from it with replacement N times. Okay, so you're actually just doing the bootstrap on this subsample. So it's actually clearly correct. You got to do a little theory to prevent stuff, but it's kind of, in some sense, obviously correct that you're doing the right thing. Now, that was on one subsample, and it's going to be a noisy bootstrap. It's correct, but it's noisy. But why not do it multiple times? All right, and average the result. So that's the bagging of little bootstraps. So we're going to run bootstraps on little bits of data, and then we're going to average the results. All right, so the key idea, which is new, there's a long literature on the bootstrap, but this idea has not, to our belief, occurred. What you do is you bootstrap the subsample. That means resampling N times as a replacement, not B times as a subsampling. So here's a picture. I think I'll skip ahead of the picture. It is this two-level thing. You start the original data. You subsample it a bunch of times. And now think computationally, that's on one server, and each one of these is on an independent server. And then on that server, it's getting a small number of data points, B, and then it's running the bootstrap on those locally on that server. All right, so that means it resamples with replacement N times conceptually, although you don't blow it up to N, you keep it at B and then retain weights. And then hopefully your procedure can do like weighted least squares or weighted GLM or weighted whatever, and many procedures can. And then you get your quality estimate and then you average the quality estimates. Okay. And so the mathematical side of this is actually just reassure yourself in the last stage of averaging you haven't lost anything. And so we do have some theory here. I think I'm going to, before I get, I'll mention the theory here, but let me just ask, does this work in practice? And the answer is yes. We've done this on a whole bunch of real data and Monte Carlo. Here's this exact same experiment as before. So time on this axis and relative error to the truth, bootstrap. And here for all values of that exponent is the bag of little bootstraps. Okay, so we don't have sensitivity to this hyperparameter. It's really working. In fact, it's beating the bootstrap. And that's just on one processor. If we do this on a distributed set of processors, like we can, you beat the bootstrap greatly. Okay, so a little bit of theory, for the reasons of time, I'm not going to belabor this, just to say that you can open up Peter Hall's book on the bootstrap and basically adapt his Edgeworth-style analysis to this, and we've done that, and it's really not that hard. The key idea of the bootstrap is that you beat the central limit theorem, you get instead of 1 over square root of n accuracy, you get 1 over n. It's a beautiful fact about the bootstrap, and you'd maybe worry that here in the averaging you lost that somehow, but you don't. So we have a consistency theorem, and then we have a rate theorem, and I'm just going to skip ahead It's just, again, one of these kind of Edgeworth stories. At the end of the day, you get a rate, which is one of a brand, just like the regular old Bootstrap. Okay, so there's a paper on this. It's on archive, and I encourage you to have a look. We've actually been working further on this. There's all kinds of extensions to the Bootstrap for dependent data in particular. I guess that's the theme of the workshop. This is IID. But one of the beauties of the Bootstrap is that it applies, and there's many clever ways to use it for dependent data. And there's still issues there, actually. Interesting things like graphs. How do you subsample or resample graphs and things? That's still unresolved. But in principle, you would want to do Bootstrap on those. So anyway, we've been playing with those kind of issues recently. Okay, that was the first third of the talk, although that was probably the longer section. And then I have another set of slides here that I hope that didn't disappear. There it is. Okay. For the second two parts of the talk. All right, so that was just kind of an interesting, hopefully found interesting use of divide and conquer principle. The second part is going to be the quickest part. It's going to be at a matrix completion. It's even a simpler version of divide and conquer. I put this up here for two reasons. First of all, I just think this is going to be true of lots of our classical procedures. It's easy to do divide and conquer in them. And then you got to do some theory to reassure yourself you didn't do something stupid. Okay, so there's going to be a lot more room for theory here. Algorithmically, we're not going to do a lot of thinking. So let's talk about example here. We have an algorithm called divide, factor, and conquer. Again, recognize collaborators here. On this matrix completion, it's Lester, Mackey, and Amit Talwalkar. And then on the matrix concentration, which will be the bulk of the rest of my talk, it's Lester and the latter three authors. Lester and I were working on these ideas together, and then three other people happened to have been working on the same ideas at the same time. We all came together and wrote a joint paper. That's the stuff on Stein's method we'll get to later. Okay, so the first part of this is matrix completion. Again, I don't think I need to belabor some of this. Many of you have probably worked on matrix completion. This little section of the talk is going to be a bunch of notation. I don't really want to get into it. I don't care that you absorb all the details here. You probably already know it. I just want to bring out a couple of themes. Okay, so matrix completion problem is that I've got a matrix with many unobserved entries, and there's some sampling pattern that leads to the missing data. I'd like to fill in the missing values in some way. So the Netflix problem, page ranking, link prediction are all examples of this. And there are nice algorithms now and guarantees, good theoretical guarantees for them. Let me just sort of jump into that here. So let's just remind you of the problem. You have to make some sort of assumption. You have most of your data missing. How are you going to do statistics in that setting? Well, you make a fairly strong but useful, reasonable assumption. In particular, low rank assumptions are often made here. So you assume that the truth, some matrix L naught, is could be factored as a column, thin column matrix times a thin row matrix. But even under that assumption, you still have some issues to deal with. First of all, if you were to have a bad sampling pattern, for example, you didn't sample an entire column, you couldn't recover the column, so you kind of have to have some assumption that that doesn't happen very often. And another assumption you have to kind of make is that you don't get situations like this, where all my information is concentrated in single entries. So if the matrix is that, and I don't happen to sample that one, I don't recover, I get all zeros matrix. So you have to somehow assume that the information is spread out over the matrix. And there are many ways to do that. A kind of a common one is some notion of coherence, or something called mu r coherent, and it has to do with something about how you align with the unit bases. It's kind of the standard assumptions that are not unrelated to those in regression for sparse regression. So anyway, making assumptions like that, you then set up an optimization problem, which is a relaxation of a hard problem. So the hard problem is to minimize the rank. You can't do that. It's intractable. So you relax that into minimize the nuclear norm. And you have these constraints, which are the same above and below, saying that on the observed entries in the matrix, you're close to those. You didn't lose too much in the actual data. And this problem can be solved in polynomial time. And the question is, if you solve that problem, how close are you to the actual L naught? And so here's a standard kind of theorem, which is that your estimator based on this relaxation is close to L naught, and there's a rate of convergence given there, and this is under the assumptions that I mentioned earlier, some kind of uniform sampling and a coherence assumption on the matrix. All right, so anyway, you probably have seen talks about this. Many authors have worked on this in a very active field. Now, the problem with this is that these algorithms don't scale. They're all based on singular value decomposition, which is notably a cubic algorithm, and so it works on modest problems. It doesn't work on the problems that we're interested in real life, for the most part. Okay, so how can we deal with this? Again, we have a little bit of a problem here. That you give me more of my data, I, as a statistician, I'm now embarrassed that my algorithms don't run on those, and I've got to, I don't know what to do. I don't want to throw away my data. All right, so you can now just think about a simple divide and conquer scheme. And so we have a kind of a framework called divide, factor, combine, which takes the original matrix, it's going to break it into pieces, and it's going to do matrix completion on each piece using an existing algorithm, and then it's going to bring the pieces back together and integrate them. Very simple divide and conquer procedure. So here's one example of this we call DFC project. So it divides the matrix into column, by columns, into sub, thin matrices, and then it does matrix completion in parallel on separate processors just to get C1 hat, C2 hat, CN hat. So those are matrix completion algorithms. You get factorizations of each of those thin matrices on each processor. And you bring them all together by a projection operator. So in this case, we projected on the column space of the first matrix factorization. Okay, we can also do this on other column spaces. We just picked one here, and in general, we do it on multiple of them and average. So now we call that, those are ensemble versions of these algorithms. All right, but at the end of the day, anyway, you run separately, get matrix completion, and project on some space that allows you to aggregate everything together. Okay, so it's just simple divide and conquer. And why would you want to do this? Well, now you can, if you are going to run the SVD locally, you have these nice thin little columns. It's cheap to do it on each separate processor, and then when you aggregate, that's cheap too. That's just production. So the overall cost here is much reduced. And then you do the theory. So this is where you really need to be a theoretician to some degree. There's a simple little procedure there. Computer scientists could have thought of this and did it, but does it work? Did you not lose something in this algorithmic stage? And so we proved a theorem that basically it sort of adapts to existing results, but there's some new things that had to be done. And the new things I'm going to tell you about later, kind of Stein's method issues. So I'm not giving the proof ideas. Let me now convince you that it works. Here is as a function of the percent of the revealed entries of some of these matrices. So you really see what regime we're in. This is the high missing data regime. I only give you 2% of the entries in the matrix and ask you to fill it in. So that's more the reality. The base matrix completion algorithm is the black curve. So it's really doing well, right? By 2% already, it's getting an answer which is nearly as good as when you reveal 10% of the entries. And then, eventually that curve will go to zero at 100, but it's already pretty darn good. Now the new algorithms, there's a whole bunch of them. I didn't get into all the details here, but two of the favorable, particularly good ones, by 2%, this one is actually doing as well as the base algorithm. And this one is doing as well by 4%. So these are quite competitive in terms of accuracy with the base algorithm. It's only in the very, very far regime that, there's a little bit of a gap. Okay, but so again, why do you do this? Well, for the time complexity. So here's the number of rows and columns, 50,000. So these are pretty big matrices. And here is the base matrix completion algorithm. And you can see that cubic growth, which is making the time kind of go through the roof. And so this works on modest scale problems, but it's not going to work on the big problems that you have at Google and Facebook and so on and so forth. Can't do it. All right, so instead of subfamily data, we don't do that. We do this divide and conquer procedure. And there are many examples of them. They all lie on top of each other here. And so the growth, which is still cubic because it is running an SVD as an inner loop, is much reduced. The constant has come down so much so that this starts to become realistic on large scale problems. This is actually being used in industry right now. I think it is the state of the art algorithm for large scale matrix completion. We did it on the actual Netflix data set. So 17,000 movies, 480,000 users, 100 million ratings, very sparse matrix. There is an algorithm called APG, which is kind of, if you're going to just run one algorithm, the state-of-the-art algorithm. It gets, on this data set, root mean squared error of 0.8433. And these new algorithms can achieve the same error at a much reduced time, in fact, order of magnitude faster. Okay, so that's the second part of the talk. Again, simple idea, just do divide and conquer, and then we have to do some mathematics to prove it, and this can have now a big practical impact. We can go back in the industry and be a little less embarrassed about our procedures. All right, but now how do you do this kind of theory? And this is, I think the future is going to be more theoretical in some sense, even though we're all becoming more applied. At the same time, our procedures get more complicated, and to analyze them, you have to do more theory. And so I'm going to spend the last part of the talk here talking about one of my favorite theoretical techniques that I think is going to be widely used for problems like this, and that's Stein's method. So how many of you know what Stein's method is already? Just Jeff, all right, okay. So it's a West Coast method, I guess that's the problem. Okay, so good, that was a kind of a teaching opportunity here too. Stein's method is something you probably want to learn about, and in particular, if this is a workshop about dependent data, and suppose I'm trying to do, I want to get a central limit theorem, I want to get weak convergence, right? If I have IID data, there's lots of ways to do that, and, you know, Fourier kind of methods are, you know, very natural. But if I have dependent data, Fourier methods are not very natural. Characteristic functions are not natural, they don't work. So what's available to you, so Stein's method's available to you. It's one of the sort of seven ways to prove the central limit theorem. It does other things too, but it's one of the few ways out in life to prove the central limit theorem. And it does it in a completely different way than the characteristic function approaches. So it basically sets up a differential equation, which is true if and only if the distribution is Gaussian. Okay, so it's a characterization of the Gaussian, yet another characterization of the Gaussian. There are many characterizations of the Gaussian, it's one of them. Very different, it's based on a differential equation. So now you can think, well, if I approximately solve that differential equation, then maybe I'm approximately Gaussian. I can start to talk about weak convergence. And that's kind of the idea behind Stein and work with differential equations. And I didn't say anything about independence, IID, et cetera. It's just a differential equation. So in fact, it's quite easy to use on a variety of dependent data problems. Okay, now, there's books on Stein's method. I encourage you to pick them up, read them. They're great. They're all about weak convergence. They're all about distributional results. All right? Now, a lot of these problems, trying to get the actual distribution, especially asymptotics, is not what we're trying to do. We don't need the whole distribution. We just need to say something, some error is going to zero to convince ourselves we have a decent method. And we don't want to do asymptotics for the reason I alluded to earlier. We're kind of often not in the asymptotic regime. Okay, so we don't want to use that version of Stein's method. Luckily, there is been a bit of work, but a very tiny sliver of work on using Stein's method in a different way, which is to do large deviations or matrix or concentrations. And so this work is an extension of that to make the world of random matrices. So this brings together random matrices with large deviations, which is kind of a brand new area. All right, so let's talk a little about the setting here. So random matrices, just again, you probably have again heard talks about it. It's a wonderful field. It's hard to get distributional results. There now are some classical, well-known distributions for random matrices. It's not for the faint of heart, and there's, you know, it's hard to extend them to various other dependencies and so on and so forth. So we don't want to go for the distributions of the random matrices. We want to go for simple features of the random matrices like tail bounds. So in particular, we're going to be interested in things like the probability in some norm that a matrix X minus its mean fluctuates by bigger than T. We're interested in, and in particular, I'm going to focus on the maximal eigenvalue of the matrix X and how what's the probability that's bigger than its mean. So I want non-asymptotic control of those kind of probabilities. And there's going to be a bunch of applications. The one I talked about already is this one here, but there's many, many other situations where you want large deviations for random matrices, where these tools can be used. Okay, so there's our problem again. We want to bound the maximal eigenvalue of a matrix. All right, now, matrix multiplication is not commutative. This is the kind of the big problem here. How much time do I have? Who's running the show here? About 15 minutes. Okay, thank you. I have a couple of tutorial slides on large deviations. And I think that given this on it, I think that would be a very appropriate thing to do. Yes, I did this for an audience the other day. There we go. Yes, this is one slide, actually. So I'm going to show you where the large deviation argument breaks, the classical argument breaks down because of the non-commutativity issue. So here we go. Large deviations 101. Oops, what happened there? Oh, yeah, I got to do it again. The full page view. Oh, that's tiny. Do you guys see it in the back? Is it okay? Okay, so there we go. All right, so I don't know why that happened. You still see it? No, you can't see it at all now. Let me go back to this. I'll just be like that. Okay, there we go. So we're interested in the probability of a fluctuation as a random variable. Let's don't do vectors now. So what's probability x is bigger than t? Okay, so here we go. So you take the exponential, you multiply by theta, which is positive. You take the exponential, you haven't changed the event. So the probability is the same. And that should have been a less than or equal. That's a bug here.
You now use Markov's inequalities. The probability of something is bigger than something is less than or equal to the expectation of the something divided by the right-hand side. That's Markov's inequality. And then that you recognize the moment generating function, and so you have that your tail bound is upper bounded by moment generating function divided by an exponential. All right, now that's true for any value of theta, so it's true for the infimum over theta. So where's the next step? There's the next step. Now you take the infimum on the right hand side and you get your tail bound. And I think that argument, maybe Jeff or someone else can tell me, it goes back to Bernstein and maybe even before. It's often, Chernoff gets some credit and so on, but it's a really old argument in statistics, probability. And so now you start doing your work. This is just a nice little function, and you have to do this moment generating function. That's what you have to control. And how do you control moment generating functions? Well, if you have independence and X is formed as an IID sum right here, all right, then you plug that in, there's your IID sum, and then exponential of sum is the product of the exponentials, and then their IID, so the expectation comes inside the product, and now you've got a single moment generating function on a single variable, and their IID, so it's just a product to the nth power of one of them. So that's the usual classical steps. And now you can, the moment generating function of a single variable is often has a nice form, and maybe you do a little bit more playing with it to get a nice, clean analytical result. And that's how you get Chernoff bounds and Bernstein inequalities and all the list of them. These are the steps. Okay, so great. But what about random matrices? There's a problem, which is that exponential of the sum of the random matrices is not equal to the product of the exponentials, random or not. E to the A plus B is not equal to E to the A times E to the B for matrices. So this whole argument runs aground. It's been appreciated, but just has kept people from working on large deviations from random matrices. So that's one problem. The other problem is the independence. That classical argument deeply used the independence. What if the Y's are not independent? Okay, so that's a problem, and so I'm claiming that Stein is going to solve both those issues at one fell swoop. So let's go back to Stein now. All right. Back to full screen mode. Good. Okay, so there's been some work, and it's very recent work, and basically it gets into some fairly deep ideas in matrix analysis, kind of not the easy stuff, just to kind of get around this problem, but not sort of directly aim at the problem, I think is a fair way to say it. There's some limitations. There's limitations. It's just not probably end of the story. Okay, so we're going to work on this approach from the point of view of Stein's method. And so we're going to have a little background, give you some tail inequalities, and then I'm going to also talk about moments briefly if I have time, and that's going to be it. So just a little notation. Our matrices are going to be Hermitian. In this talk, these ideas all go through for non-Hermitian matrices, actually. I can tell you about that. We have maximum eigenvalues, we have traces, and we have norms and then p-norms for the moments. Okay, so here's our key page of definitions. So exchangeability just means if you swap the order of the random variables, the distribution doesn't change. That's what it means to be exchangeable. So we have an exchangeable pair, z and z prime. All right, now we're going to take that randomness and we're going to pump that through a function psi, and we're going to get x and x prime, and they're clearly still exchangeable. Those will be now matrices. And we're going to define a matrix Stein pair to be a pair of matrices such that the conditional expectation of one of the matrices given the other one, or given the randoms underlying the other one, is a factor times the original matrix. Okay, so in applications, this factor will turn out to hopefully be kind of a small number. So this is near the original matrix. So the classical way of doing this with random variables, where X is the IID sum, which is not the usual application of Stein's method, but it's a simple one, is that you take the X equals sum of I equal 1 to N of YI. You define x prime to be, you take one of the sumands out and you plug in an independently chosen new sumand. Okay, so you have essentially the same sum as before, but one of the sumands has changed. All right, so it's easy to see that alpha in that case will be 1 over n. You just change one of the sumands. All right, so it's close to the original, and it's easy to see that it's exchangeable. Okay, the two things have the same distribution. If I swap the order, nothing changes. All right, in other situations, you set up the exchangeable pair in some clever way. You thought about your problem, you thought about what's its structure, and you find a different random variable which kind of is close to that random variable in that structure. And you calculate alpha, hopefully. And it's often easy to do. Okay, so from that definition, you can prove that these x and x prime are exchangeable. It's trivial. And you can prove they have zero mean, also trivial. Just hit that equation with expectation. All right, now let's start to control variances. So we're going to see that just by controlling variances, we're going to get our large deviation results. So it's a random variance. So here's our definition. This object delta of x is the conditional expectation, conditional on one of the matrices, or the randomness underlying the matrix, we're calling that z, of the difference between one matrix and the other squared. Okay, so why is that a variance-like quantity? Well, if I plug in the mean of x and minus and plus, and then I'm going to break it apart, I'm going to get two of them. They have the same distribution by exchangeability, and the twos will add, they'll add together, and the two will cancel the 1/2. All right, so it is actually, when I take another expectation there, I get the variance. So that's a random matrix whose expectation is the variance. So we call it the conditional variance. All right, so why do I introduce that? Well, it's going to come out in our math that if we control this quantity, we control the thing we care to control about. So just remember that definition. I'm going to jump right to a theorem, and then I'm going to kind of tell you how, back up and how we prove this theorem. So let's suppose that you can control the conditional variance in the following way. It can be upper bounded by a constant times x plus a constant times the identity matrix. You now figure out what constants make that be true. And if you can do that, then the fluctuation is upper bounded by the dimensionality of the problem times an exponential where the constants appear down here. So that has the form of a Bernstein bound. If I put my hand over this part right here, it looks like a central. It looks like a Gaussian tail. If I, in the other regime, I get Poisson limits. So it's a merger of the Poisson and the Gaussian limits that we associate with Bernstein. Okay, so I'm going to kind of tell you how we prove this. This is kind of the master theorem, or one of the master theorems for concentration. A corollary of this is a kind of a Huffington-style bound, which is that if I assume further that I have zero mean and I have each one of the matrices has a upper bound which can be indexed by k, so it's a constant matrix A squared, and I define a variance-like parameter to be the sum of the A squareds plus their variances, because they have zero mean, that's a variance. Add that all up, take the norm, and then I get a large deviation bound where that variance appears down here, just like you get in a Huffington bound. Now, there has existed a matrix Huffington inequality. It's a paper by Joel Tropp in 2011. This improves on that bound in that the constant is better, and it's proved in a different way. In fact, it has the optimal constant, and an interesting fact is that when I set d equal to 1, I'm back to the scalar case. And this actually improves on the Huffington inequality. So it's a different way to get a similar bound to Huffington, which actually improves on it. Okay, so how do you prove this stuff? Okay, well, it's not that hard. So briefly, sorry, my few minutes remaining, I'm going to give you the outline argument. There is a paper on this that goes through it slowly. Okay, so it's the same sort of first few steps before. We'll get an upper bound, a fluctuation, by a moment-generating function times divided by e to the theta t, and then we're going to take the infimum. Now, the moment-generating function is a little bit different here. It's a trace of the matrix exponential. Now, where did the trace come from? Well, these lambdas are the eigenvalues of an exponential matrix are all positive. And so the maximal eigenvalue is upper bounded by the trace, because they're all positive. So that's where the trace comes from. Okay, so now how are you going to bound that moment-generating function? That's the whole argument comes down to that, without using independence. All right. Well, this is basically called the fundamental theorem of calculus, right? Which is that I want to bound a quantity m of theta. What I'm going to do instead is calculate m prime, I'm going to take the derivative, and I'm going to bound the integral of the derivative. Now, why did you do that? Well, the derivative might be easier to bound, and then you approach the integral, you approximate each little step, and the total thing can be bounded more tightly than if you just went from the get-go. This argument occurs in chaining and empirical processes. It's a Herbst argument, and it is all over the place in some sense, and it's now kind of being brought into this Stein inequality stuff. We're using exchangeable pairs. All right, now, so let's assume that you buy that argument. There's the moment-generating function we're trying to bound. If I take its first derivative, here it is. That x came down. Now, I have a trace of one matrix times another. That's an inner product. So there's some geometry immediately, inner product. I could maybe work with inner products. I can maybe bound them. So we're going to rewrite the inner product using exchangeable pairs. And this is kind of where the Stein thinking comes in. And this is kind of the main result here, is that we're going to try to upper bound inner products, a matrix times another matrix. All right? And if you now created an exchangeable pair, x and x prime, then you can show that this is actually an easy little, like, three lines. I just didn't write them out. It's a little bit of conditional expectation calculations. That interproc can be rewritten as x times its exchangeable brethren times the f of x minus f of x prime. All right, now why did you want to do that? Well, we need to bound that, and here x is probably close to x prime if I chose a good exchangeable pair, so that's nearly zero. And then f's a nice continuous function, smooth function, so that difference might be near zero too. So maybe I can get my hands on both pieces of the right-hand side, and therefore bound the left-hand side. All right, so anyway, if you try to play with that yourself, you might actually do that. You will be following the footsteps of Stein to kind of make that is what part of the idea of Stein's. All right, so let's go now back to our main thrust of our argument. We're trying to bound m prime, and then we use the fundamental theorem of calculus. So there's m prime, and we're now using the limit to plug it in, and we're using our specific f of x, which is exponential. So I now have to work on that right-hand side there. All right, and now we have one little lemma, which I'm going to just mention. This is what you need to make that argument go. It's in our paper. This is kind of a piece of new math that needed to be done. It's a little kind of mean value theorem for functions of matrices, basically. So I got a difference of functions of matrices. You can rewrite that. You need the trace there, by the way. Without the trace, this wouldn't work. You can rewrite that as a difference times, you bring out the difference of the argument, and then you get derivatives. So kind of, it's a mean value theorem-like thing. All right. So there you go. With that in hand, you now return, and we're nearly done with the argument. There's the thing at the top I was trying to bound. I use that little lemma, and I get the difference of the argument x minus x prime coming outside, and then I get a square, and then I get the derivatives inside, and I get a plus sign instead of a minus sign, the mean value theorem. All right, now why did I do that? Well, now I can do a double, I can do a conditional expectation calculation. I can condition on x on the inside, and so take this latter term, put it together with the first one, condition on x, and now I get the conditional variance by definition, because that's a constant. And I get the conditional variance appearing there. And if I do the other one, well, by exchangeability, it's got to be the same. All right, so I can condition on x prime, if you will, and I get the same, and then x prime and x have the same distribution, so I get twice the conditional variance, and so I get the conditional variance multiplied by that thing right there. All right, so the thing I was trying to bound is upper bounded by this. All right, now that's a nice little smooth function, and that's the thing that I need to make, you know, that's what I made some assumption, I controlled in some way. So now we're back to our theorem. If you can get control on this, you can control the thing you care to control. So if we put in that bound then, and you just plug it in at this point, you put in x here times e to x, well, that's just the m prime. You put in identity times e of x, that's just m. And so I get that m prime is less than or equal to m prime plus. I get a little differential equation, differential inequality. You just solve that. All right, you solve that, and now you have an upper bound on m of theta, the moment Jordanian function. You plug that back into your Bernstein-style argument, your Chernoff, Hufting, however you want to call it, and you're good to go. All right, so that's the entire argument. It's actually elementary. I hope you see that it's elementary. You can pick up these big books on Stein's method. It looks quite difficult and complicated. This version applied to large deviations is elementary. Okay, so we can now bound around to matrices using Stein's thinking. That's the kind of the key here. So that's it. I'm done with the exponential concentrations. That's what we use to prove the stuff back to matrix completion, and I think this will have lots of other applications. We've written a kind of an applied-oriented paper on this. That has the math, but also kind of hopefully makes clear what the applications are going to be of this. So that's for exponential concentrations. A lot of situations you want to bound moments of these matrices, not the tail probabilities. And there is a version, these same arguments really, with almost very little change, go through and give you that master theorem. It is in the scalar case, this is called the Burkholder-Davis-Gundy inequality, and so this generalizes that to the matrix world. It also applies much more broadly to infinite dimensional operators. And if you specialize that to, here's an interesting class of random matrices, where I got some deterministic matrices and Rademacher variables. You just plug that back in the previous theorem, you get this thing, and that's called a Kinching inequality. It's really important in applied matrix analysis, and it's proved in completely different ways than this, and it's viewed as hard to prove. And this is an elementary way to get the Kinching, a matrix Kinching inequality, which I think is probably maybe the most useful thing we've done here. The constant there you can show is nearly optimal, so an elementary argument basically gives a non-commutative Kinching inequality. So I am done. Last page here just to show you about some of the other things that we are considering or can be done. We have got this matrix, we're approaching the field of random matrices through the lens of Stein's method. So that's new. And it allows you to get general Bernstein-type inequalities. I talked about Hermitian matrices off the talk, but there's a nice trick that allows you to go to the non-Hermitian case. You just take your non-Hermitian matrix B, you take its complex conjugate, you form that matrix, that's called a dilation, and that matrix now is Hermitian, and so you apply your results to that, and of course the eigenvalues are preserved by this operation, so you get now bounds on B by using the Hermitian argument. So all ideas for a Hermitian transfer to non-Hermitian via dilation. A very cute trick if you didn't know about it already. And then I didn't talk about dependent sequences here in this part of the talk, just to keep the thing in, you know, tutorial mode, but all these ideas, I never used independence. I never said the word independence in that entire set of arguments. So there are a wide variety of independence cases where this applies to. We've looked at a few of them, but not really that many. So I invite you, if you find this stuff interesting, to look at our paper and think about some of the dependence cases. Some of them will be really quite interesting and not that hard, and I think kind of a lot of oomph to them. Okay, so I covered a lot. I'm all woken up, and I look forward to the rest of the talks for the day, and I'm happy to answer some questions if there are any.